welcome to Offscript and Onside with me, Brian Moore. Now, I would normally be Jim Carter, but Jim can't be here. He's on a break at the moment. But anyone who knows anything about rugby will probably tell you that the compensation is that I've got a genuine rugby icon with me. She's won World Cups. She's won Grand Slams. She's in the Rugby Hall of Fame. Maggie Alfonsi, MBE. Soon to be a dame, I predict. Would you like to be a dame?
I would love to be a dame. I mean, I could jump queues. I could, you know.
So nothing to do with lawmaking in the House of
Lords? No, none of that serious stuff. Queue jumping.
And better tables.
Yeah, going to Nando's, getting free food. That's what I'm really hoping would happen in the future.
One of those lords, eh? Okay, fair enough. Yeah, look, Maggie, World Cup winner, Hall of Famer, and serial Grand Slam winner, and now you're not doing it. You're reduced, if that's the right word, like I am, to messing around on the TV occasionally. Now, anywhere near playing?
Do you know, I love working in broadcasting. I think what I love about it is that it has the same element of pressure. You know, you test your knowledge, and in a weird way, you sort of educate the viewer, or you provide knowledge to the viewer, and I like that. I do miss playing, don't get me wrong.
How
there's
often
a match,
do you miss playing? Every day?
No, not every day, definitely not every day. I don't miss it on a Monday when I see players who are just slowly struggling after their games. But I miss the camaraderie. I miss the smell of deep heat. I just miss that sort of, like, these are my teammates and I get to, you know, win.
Do you
or lose
miss
with
this
them.
Element? Because this is one thing that's always got me, and over the years I've considered it more. The great thing about sport, and rugby is definitely part of this, is the objectiveness of the result. You score more points, I've won. I don't care what you think about me. I don't care if you think I'm no good, because actually it's up there and I've won. Broadcasting, like a lot of things, it is very subjective, because some people like you and some people don't, and they make it quite plain on social media. So I've always preferred that bit where it's under my control, and at least I don't have to, at least people, well, generally, they don't say, well, I didn't like that, you know, I didn't like your hairstyle, I didn't like what you're wearing, which I know, unfortunately, does come sometimes with female presenters.
It does, yeah, but Brian, everyone loves you. Everyone keeps telling me that, oh, we love Brian, he's back, we love it. I always wait for it. He's going to say something about the referee. Wait for him to say something about the referee and feeding the scrum. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think what I like about rugby, it is very much black and white. You know, what you see is what you get. But you're right, broadcasting is very different. It's subjective. It's great.
I think what's interesting, to me at least, is the way in which I've seen you prepare. Take yourself off on your own, doing your lines, rehearsing in a way that, you know, I imagine you did when you were going through your mental drills prior to a game.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, I tell you, because we do different roles when we're broadcasting. Yeah. You're the commentator, and I guess I would be the pundit. And you're right, I have my notes, almost probably similar to a commentator. I have my notes, I sort of go through it, I practice it, I visualise what's going to happen in the show and how I'm going to deliver. I've also hired some, I guess, presenter coaches who support me on my journey. So actually, we do a lot of work before we get to the game.
How does that work?
Yeah, so I guess we'll go over the game from last weekend. Or I don't know what day this is today, but we'll go over the game that happened previously, and we'll talk about, okay, what we could have done differently, you know, me on the day, and, you know, what your responses could have been. And then we'll look forward to the game going ahead. You know, let's talk about it. What are the things that you feel would be the relevant points? So it's like having coaches. I treat it exactly like a player. Have my coaches. They
challenge me. Go to the depth of things, like your voice could have been lower there, higher there, sound too excited.
Use them for that. So I used to have a voice coach and someone who used to teach me elocution lessons as well. And I used them to help develop my voice and when to go high, when to go low, when to be very, you know, have authority. So I've done it all.
Lower,
sometimes
slower for the role.
Lower, slower. Yeah. But the reality is, because when you turn up on the day and you do the game, it kind of goes out the window a little bit, because you've got to be authentic and you don't know what kind of questions are going to come at you. And also you've got usually two or three other people who are part of your panel who you've got to, like, bounce off, you know? And but I've seen your prep, Brian. I love it. I mean, because you just come in, you're very chilled and very relaxed. And then you and Katie, Daley McLean, and Sarah Orchard would just deliver. So
I like to do all mine away. I read stuff and then I just let it go, because And I wouldn't be the same relaxed person had I not done it in the background, because it's not professional to not turn up yes. having done that. You know, all the pronunciations and whatever. I think, you know, that's one of the things I think is shameful. If you can't be bothered to go and learn people's surnames and just do it the once,
yes.
then I think you shouldn't be there. There's no excuse for that at all.
Totally.
So I try and get mine there and then just let it come in. But that comes over time, because when I started, it wasn't like that. And that comes over having the confidence to know that actually, when the pressure comes on, you will be able to say something.
Yes.
And actually, it's more important that what comes out is authentic, like
yeah,
you said.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than, even if you make mistakes, it's better it's something okay. that way.
Brian,
around.
Let me ask you a question. Do you prefer playing, I know it was a while ago, but do you prefer playing or do you prefer doing the broadcasting side?
Well, I tell you what, broadcasting is a damn sight easier. Because you're never wrong, and if you are wrong, no one remembers, and you can say completely the opposite. But nothing beats playing. Nothing beats that, you know, that feeling when you're waiting and you're saying get on with it, and you feel sick and you feel almost joyous and nervous and the whole panoply of emotions. And that bit, I tell you what, look, I'm old now. And
you're
I'm
not
too
old.
Slow. I am old. I'm a lot older than you. Look, but don't you wish this just once?
Yeah.
You could walk out again to that ascending roar as you get there, and that inviolable feeling you feel when you walk on the field, and you feel 8 foot tall, and you're feeling, you know, you feel invulnerable, and you just think you can take on the world. Just to have that bit there. I don't have to have the anthems because yeah. we've got a crap nice yeah. anthem.
But I feel the same. So honestly, I'm so jealous of the players. Like, I love that feeling of being in the changing room. Obviously, everyone's preparing, doing their thing. We have the last team talk. Then the referee knocks on the door yeah. and says, whatever, 5 minutes, 2 minutes, like that. You can feel your stomach turning. And then when they walk you out into yeah. the tunnel and yeah. you see your, that's the first time you see the opposition properly.
Well, fully, but that's a relatively feeling. New thing. Because the first time that started was in an absolute bloodbath when we played in the quarterfinal way back in 91
yeah,
against
yeah.
France.
Yeah.
That was the first time two teams walked out together. Mm. And because it was always yeah. away side first, then home side. So you're stood there in the tunnel. And in those days, it never happened before. So you locked eyes with people. And if you never look away if you lock
yeah,
out.
Yeah, no, totally.
You've got to look away first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And 40 seconds, which is probably all it was,
yeah.
but it seemed like 2 minutes, was long enough for the chuntering to start. So you don't laugh, let go on. You won't laugh when I get you on the field. Remember this six yeah. stitches? So it was like, oh my God, then you walk on. And then that comes. And the thing about the Parc de Prance, as was then, you get live cockerels, the Dax band.
yeah.
And wherever you were, you are several strata higher.
Yeah.
So do you get any feeling of that sort of build up when you're working off pitch now?
Yeah, listen, I feel doing broadcasting has created a similar feel now to what I used to get in playing, in the sense that, you know, it's like we'll go and do rehearsals just before we go on air, usually 45 minutes before we go on air. And every now and again, you'll see the floor manager will say, OK, 20 minutes before we go on air. I'm like, it's like the referee knocking on the door. So I'm getting a bit more excited. And then we'll run over some clips, which we're going to talk about before we go on air. And then the floor manager will say 5 minutes. And I'm like, oh, this is the. And then literally just before we go on air, whoever you're being a pundit with, usually we fist pump everyone and say good luck, you've got have a good game, enjoy it. And then those in the gallery will say in our ears, have a good game, enjoy it. And that's brilliant.
How do you deal with critiquing players that you know really well,
Brian? Great question. I'd have to ask you the same thing. My attitude has always been, I try not to be too close with players, and that's the challenge a lot of players have when they retire. Usually they retire, they fall into broadcasting, and at that point they know the players incredibly well, so they don't want to say things that are going to upset players. They might know their families as well, so they don't want to say anything that's going to re-upset them. So what I always try and do is know the players, but not know them too well. And that's my own personal choice, because when I'm on air, I don't want to be influenced by anything. So that's always been my hard and fast rule. But how about you? Because obviously players.
Exactly the same. But the way I justify it is this. I say to them, look, you either take this job and do it as it's supposed to be done, which is a way, you know, we're probably going to discuss now, or don't do it at all. Because you can't half do it. If you half do it, you shortchange both sides. Tell you what, before we go on to what is going to be an interesting final now against
very,
China, England,
very
China,
interesting.
Very interesting. Your journey. Do you want to start and tell us where it began?
Yeah, so my journey officially, okay, let's go like way back. When I was born with a physical disability called clubfoot. So that's where one or both your feet are turned all the way in. Its formal name is talipesis. So my right foot was turned in, had an operation when I was young to straighten my foot. But my childhood, as a result of that, was spent a lot of time just making sure my foot was slightly, straightened. And it was a challenging time, but
so
I don't
couldn't be that active.
It couldn't be that active. So your foot generally is in a cast, and usually sometimes they put you in a boot and with a bar, and a child will have to be in that from majority of the
day. How do you get treated because of that by other kids?
The funny thing is, I can't remember a larger percentage of it. So because it's so young, it happened when you're young. So you're in the 1-2 year old category because your bones are so soft that you can have the operation. So I had to talk to my mother about it quite a lot about what was it like, and she was like, it was really difficult for her anyway, because you can imagine. My child's been born, she's got talipesis, right foot turns in, she's got to have an operation. I don't know anything about it. My mother was a single parent as well, so she had to go through all that challenges. And even now, I speak to parents who have kids who are born with talipesis, and actually it's about sort of reassuring them and saying, actually through sport, it changed my life, and it's never affected me at all. That was the beginning bit of my journey. Grew up in a council estate in North London, in Edmonton, and it was fine. Like, to be honest, it was a challenging environment. You always tried your very best to stand out, to sort of be relevant. So I was a challenging child when I was growing up, let's just say that.
Really?
Yeah, I refuse
to believe that.
That Maggie, she's an angel. She's so nice. But at school I was challenging, and I guess I just loved school, but I loved school for the wrong reasons. I was a smart child.
So when did you get into sport then?
So I found sport primary school. You know, I loved netball, did a lot of netball, a lot of rounders. Secondary school, I realised I was still good at sport because I was big and strong, like this size. I was this size at 9 years old, you know, to be fair. So nobody messed with me. I even had these arms. Look at these arms. So at primary school, I was good at sport. Secondary school, found other sports like football. So I used to even play with the lads. I used to play with the boys at playtime, football. They always put me in the goal. I was really annoyed by that. But actually, I saved a lot of goals. So I was pretty decent. And then it was my PE teacher, a lady called Lisa Burgess, who was the captain of the Welsh women's side and was the captain of Saracens. Bird, her name is.
Yeah.
And I had no idea that she did rugby outside of school. But I remember her turning up to school having black eyes and bruises, and I thought, let me ask her what she does. And she told me she played rugby, and I was like, what is this sport? Because North London, that part of the world, rugby wasn't popular. Saracens obviously was there, but still most people didn't really know the sport. You liked football. That was it. That's what you were brought up on. So she was like, do you know what? Try it out. Give it a go. So I gave it a go and I loved it. I mean, I absolutely loved it.
From the very first bit.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it was a sport where here's a ball. Run as fast as you can. Mm-hmm. There's a person. Tackle them. Ideally with the ball. But tackle them. Take them down. And then just enjoy it. Where every sport that I was involved in, being a girl, I felt like there was slight restrictions. You know, netball, only play up to that line. If I did athletics, because you're a girl,
you can't move.
I know. Contact. I was like, contact? Yeah. What do you mean? But like athletics, because you're a girl or a woman, you have to throw this size ball or this size discus. You know, that was the sort of the mindset. And I felt like when I came to rugby, it was like, it doesn't matter what your gender is. It's the same field. Mm-hmm. The ball's the same. Just, you know, tackle the same person. And I love that. So there was
it
no
is interesting
difference.
In the kids, because you see when they are introduced to contact around 7, 8, there's a sudden divide. And it's nothing to do with size or athletic ability. Some kids like contact and some don't.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't play rugby to any reasonable level at all unless you are at least very indifferent to contact. And usually, if you enjoy it, and that is nothing right or wrong with whether you do or don't, but it is a defining factor.
Oh, totally.
And that, how long was it before it was made plain to you that it was acceptable as a girl to be that way as well?
Yeah. So what was great, I've always been a physically strong character. Yeah. When I turned up to my club, which was Saracens in Copfosters, Bramley Road, I love the fact they were, that was my local club though, and I was an hour away from it, so that was rare. But I knew that they had a women and girls section. So to turn up, there were loads of girls, which was great. There's an under 16 set up and an under 18 set up. There were the women's team, they had two women's sides, which is again rare back in those days. So this is around, was it 1995, 1996, or just before 2000 period. You know, there's a lot for the women's rugby to be popular back then was rare, but to have that many size.
Did they have female coaches as well?
That's correct. Yes, we did. So my first female coach was a lady called Katie Ball.
Because that's even more unusual back then.
Yeah, I mean, it's because we had so many women playing, and then when they'd retired, they came back and helped coach the junior side. So my first coach, Katie Ball, brilliant. She actually went to Olympics as a rower, fell in love with rugby later, and was my, like, she was almost like a teacher, like a parent, like a guardian, did it all, you know, and I'm very grateful to her. Then I had another coach, Amanda Bennett, who you would know, went to Loughborough, played for Wells, was a fly half, and then became, and played at Saracens, and then became my coach as well. So I was really fortunate to have these amazing, confident, independent women who were my coaches, and I think it had an impact on me.
How much of a difference do you think it made to you as a girl or a young woman to have a female coach as opposed to a male coach? And you know, a lot of men were instrumental in trying to get help women's rugby get off the ground because simply there were more of them and they were prepared to give their time. What do you think? Is it, this is the point.
Yeah.
Is it just competence or is there an extra factor in terms of gender?
So for me, I'm so lucky. I didn't think about it. I didn't think, oh, I've got a woman as my coach or I've got a male as my coach. To be fair, I had both women and men throughout my journey. So, you know, my first coaches at club were women, but then when I got into divisional and regional, we didn't have county at the time, they were male coaches. So they all just had their impact in different ways. But not until you get older do you go, oh, there's less women, and what have I found beneficial being with having women? I thought what I found great with the women is that they got me. And because they'd been there and done it from my perspective, so they understood. And when I had the men, they hadn't been there, done that. They hadn't actually understood where I'd come from because they were men. But at the same time, they gave me their perspective, and probably I found that the way they delivered to us, they had to adapt every time because they were out of their comfort zone completely. And it's funny when I see women work with the men, you know. We also have to adapt because it's not our world, but at the same time, you find a way of aligning and you become, people start to forget that you're a woman or you're a man. It's actually, what do you know and how are you going to make me better? That's all that matters.
Well, when you're going up through the ranks and you're starting towards England, you know, the balance of male to female coaches changed, didn't it? Because, you know, there are more male, and to be fair, that part of that is seniority and the experience of having that level of coaching. And one of the things that I hope the RFU and Women in Sport will do is to get more women into the coaching aspect so that it becomes a much more acceptable. And they're simply the numbers there. At the moment, they're on the numbers there. When you're going up through that rank, would it have been better had you had female coaches coming through with you because of their innate influence and innate understanding?
So to me, and I'll say it again, like, gender has had no, it doesn't, I don't, I wouldn't have been bothered whatever the gender would have been. It's like you said, it's very much more just a knowledge and understanding. The challenge that as women we've always had is the fact that the support in our game has been, it's almost been late, you know. So no wonder you're starting to see all the fantastic coaches out there now is because they've now retired. They've now gone and been able to, you know, get their coaching qualifications, work with some amazing teams, and have now come back to be able to be in a position to be selected. The challenge sometimes is the infrastructure and whether they get selected or looked at, because some might go, I want that guy over, because that guy's well known and has got a big name, over that woman who has all the qualifications, all the experience. So that's the frustration that some women have experienced, because if I, you know, a good example, the PWR, Premiership Women's Rugby, in England here, you know, there's less women now who are coaching teams, which I find bizarre when there was a few and now they've all sort of not disappeared, but have been moved on and others have taken their role and majority of them have been males. So I just want to see good coaches. I 100% want to see more women coaches. I know they're out there. The talent path is out there. You know, a good example, when we watch the Women's Rugby World Cup now, Jo Yap, our former England player, worked at Worcester, director of rugby there for the women's setup. Also was England women's under 20s coach and obviously at Exeter University as well. She went away to Australia. She's gonna come back, and I reckon she will find her way back into the England setup. Susie Appleby is another one, is a good example. Was at Exeter, has now left. And then when we look at the World Cup, Leslie McKenzie, who's obviously working with us at the BBC coverage, she's the Japanese head coach. I just think it's great when I see the women coaching, and we just need to make sure they're more visible. And you're right, we need to do more work to ensure that there are opportunities for them. Young girls coming through thinking, I want to be a coach. I don't want to just be a player. Yeah. I want to be a coach, or I want to be an official. There are so many other roles in the world of sport.
Let's go on to the very specific challenge now, because you've won a World Cup and I haven't. Not that it bothers me.
It doesn't bother you at all. No, it doesn't. I can see.
No. Only for 20 years. It is a peculiar thing. Let's build the picture.
Yes,
England have come from the most professional outfit, nowhere near, by the way, the sort of rewards even in the men's professional game.
Yeah.
But yet still given the ability to train in that way. The expectation was before the tournament that they would sweep all before them. I think they have coped with that reasonably well now. Mm. They, because it's a home World Cup, I think they're probably still registered by a lot of people to be favourites.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you deal with that?
That's hard. Going into any tournament as a favourite is challenging, because the reality is I would rather be a hunter than be hunted.
Yeah.
Because when you're hunting, you know what you need to do. You can see them in front of you. And that's why I always say, and my mindset has always been, I love being a number two and not a number one. But for the England team, the pressure has been like, it's on their shoulders. Every time they compete against a team, I remember hearing some interviews of the, it was the Canadian players, or was it Canadian players or Scotland players, I think it might have been in the quarterfinals, saying actually the pressure's all in England, because everyone expects them to get to the final and everyone expects them to perform and they're number one in the world. So got all of those stats and achievements are on their shoulders, where the Scottish players were saying at the time, no one expects us to beat them, so we've got nothing to lose. Same with the French, got nothing to lose. And to an extent, the Canadians will feel the same. They would be like, we've got nothing to lose.
Well, so certainly, I mean, I would think this is fairly incontestable, uncontestable. The fact that, you know, England are founded in the world's biggest and best club league.
Yeah.
And the Canadians had to crowdfund part of their experience to get here.
Mm-hmm.
I would think every neutral, certainly outside the stadium, I think it will be a large contingent of England support in the stadium, will be rooting for Canada. And if I were in the England camp, I would be reminding people, because you know this, and it's nothing to do with sport, actually.
Mm.
Everyone hates England for various reasons. And I would be trying to turn that insofar as I could, you know, to get your own motivation.
Yes.
How would you, what if you were in charge, what would you be saying to the team this week?
Oh, good one. I'll flip this back on you later in a second. All right. What I would be saying to the England team would be actually a little bit of that. There's this narrative that's currently being created that, you know, Canada crowdfunded, they are the underdogs. They are creating this us versus, you know, us versus them sort of
everyone
attitude.
Versus England.
Yeah, and they're also sort of, I don't know, I think they're winning the hearts and minds of people, honestly. Everyone I speak to now, they're like, I really want Canada to do well. That says a lot, doesn't it? Because actually people perceive England to be a very rich governing body. They've got loads of money. Expectations are that they should do well. But people have now seen Canada and saw what they did against New Zealand, and people are starting to take note and go, wow, this massive country that has a very small governing body that doesn't necessarily fund their rugby, they're in the final again. So I would say to the England team, listen, you've got to take that narrative and flip it on its head and be like, actually, we deserve to be here. We're number one in the world. Let's back up our back up our achievements. At the same time, but like, let's not talk about Canada. Let's think about us. I mean, that's a general thing that people generally say. But I would be like, it's not about them. It's about us. Because I tell you now, Canada will have their own motivations.
Yeah.
It's been brewing for like 11 years for them since 2014. And then obviously they made the semi-final against England in the last World Cup and they got knocked out by England. So there's a lot of hate and anger probably building up, where for England, they've got to find their own motivation. And I guess what will be fueling in their mind is that they lost that World Cup most recently, I've seen 3 years ago, to a line-out. It's a line-out at the end. And also...
Sending off as well.
Lydia Thompson got sent off. But they could have won that. That was their World Cup to win. Could have won the one in 2017 as well. They were playing against New Zealand. They were up at half-time. They'd pretty much won the game. And then New Zealand has come back in second half. So those two World Cups, you'd like to think there's lessons learned from how they... So the first World Cup in 2017, it was game management. The one in 2022, that should have been 2021, that very much was all about decisions, big decisions and big key moments. You lost a player, that was significant. But then again, New Zealand lost a player. But that final moment of catching that ball in the line-out was significant.
All these macro factors, like destiny, about fulfilling your promise and so on, one of the responsibilities, I think, is to back the RFU's backing, you know, because the RFU, and we give them a lot of stick sometimes.
Yeah, you do.
I do. But they were the first ones to get off the backsides and put money into a professional league, which has become the global leader. And people are trying to catch up now because they realise that. So to pay that back as well, I think that's a responsibility that is there. But to me, in this week, these factors have been there all the time.
Yes.
And they should have dealt with them by now. And they should have been chatting through this. And I'm pretty sure they have. Mm. The closer you get to the game, and this is a cliche, isn't it, Maggie? You know, play the game, not the occasion.
Yeah.
Because this is actually what matters. Mm. So the closer you get to the game, the more specific you come, right down to the mornings. You know, it would be inhuman if you're not thinking about the sort of thing, you know, about wider things and publicity. But actually, you need to stop yourself and say, right, it comes down to this. First kickoff, are we going to catch it? Or we're going to have the player behind drop it again, like it did in the quarterfinals and semifinals.
Yeah.
You know, are we going to get our guards and bodyguards round the breakdown down? Because Lepetiere is the fulcrum of a lot of their attacks. Mm-hmm. She has to be hit and hit early. She's not to be allowed to run. The big carriers are not allowed to go beyond the gain line, and nor are they going to be allowed to offload the ball close where we can't defend them. Our bits out wide, and sometimes we've got caught slightly narrow and we've been too easy to get on. So you're thinking about all these specific things. So all these other aspects are taken out of the way and you're focused on that. And if you can build on that and you can have a good start, then the confidence comes right. And also, it's taking away the possible bonuses, because if Canada were to get a lead...
Yeah.
It's much easier to hang on to things, isn't it?
Yeah.
Physically,
yeah.
When you're in the lead.
Yeah.
If you're down and having to strive and the crowd gets behind you, that's what you've got to take away. You've got to take away all these elements and just be ruthless about it. But doing that is a very specific process. Yeah. It's not a general thing.
Bro, you've pumped me up, man. If I was in that change rooms now, I'm ready to go. Like, bring him on. I'm like ready to start. Honestly, I think the key thing is just like, also just, you touched on, embrace the occasion. They've done this so much in terms of strategy, the what ifs, who to be defending, who to stop. I feel like this England team will know what they need to do. I also think the Canadian team will know what they need to do. Both of these teams are evenly matched.
This will be the biggest crowd that either team have played in front of. And to be honest, there's a lot of very good players have not played in front of 82,000 people. And it does make a difference. The bigger the crowd, it does, you know, the adrenaline is bigger. Do you see anything in the fact that some of the players haven't actually experienced that before?
Yeah, it's interesting. So people might go, oh, the Canadian players haven't experienced that just because 15s rugby isn't massive over there and they wouldn't have those crowds. But actually, some of the players in the Canadian side would have played sevens.
In the Olympics?
Yeah. They would have gone to the Olympics. Everyone knows the Olympics that just went in France, you know, there was huge crowds for the sevens rugby because Dupont was obviously there. So they had been used to playing in front of what, 60,000, 70,000, I can't remember how what the capacity was in the stadium. So that for some of those players, actually, they are quite comfortable with that. I mean, England will have the advantage of having that regularly, you know, during the Six Nations. I think the game against France back in 2003, 50, 60, they'd a large number attend that, and most recent games as well have been hitting 40,000. So the England team will be used to that over the Canadians. So that will be a defining factor, playing in front of a crowd capacity. So it's about who can actually manage that, because you know it's like, I mean, I've not played in front of 82,000. I've played in 50,000. That's been the max. And that's when I played sevens as well. But when you walk out, like you're standing in a tunnel, you're eyeing up your opposition, you're ready to take them down. Then the doors open up and then you walk out and wow, the roar. And there's going to be an absolute roar. The fireworks will be going. There's one thing about knowing what you need to do, but being in that occasion and then almost being a fox in headlights, it's going to be amazing.
I mean, there's a big debate in sport, isn't there, about whether there's such a thing as momentum. And I do believe there is a thing.
Yeah.
Having been on pitches where you've felt it swing against you. The problem is, you've got to do four things when it goes. And this is why I think the team that gets the best start, that will go a long way to deciding a game with two relatively even teams at the moment. You've got to understand what's going wrong.
Yeah, wrong.
Think about it. You've got to identify the solution.
Yeah.
You've got to be able physically and mentally and have the talent to put it right, and then you've actually got to do it.
So all these
four things are required, and it's no good having three of them because it just doesn't work, and that takes time sometimes. It's not what's immediately obvious to us off the pitch is not necessarily the same on it at all, is it? And you can have things fed onto you, but even then, unless it's really specific. And you still then, even if the solution's identified, you've still got to go and do it.
Totally.
And that is not always easy against an opposition that is trying desperately, you know, to keep that momentum. So I think these swings, and they will come backwards and forwards against it. But I think it's, for England especially, I just think it's really crucial not to get off to a bad start.
Do you know what, bro? I'm gonna throw this new question in. Because the tournament's been amazing.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'd love to know from your perspective, being a man in particular, what do you think the tournament has done for women's rugby in England? Or actually generally, globally?
I think what it's shown is that if you get to the standard they've got to now, you don't need to make any accommodations for the difference in sex. Mm. It is the game that rugby people know and have loved for, you know, a long, long time, for a century. Without any accommodation for anything. And that in itself doesn't sound apocalyptic, but just getting that acceptance. I mean, my old boys, the old Crossland, Halifax,
yeah.
a very unreconstructed old, no, that's not true, but a traditional old boys.
Mm-hmm.
I've been speaking to them and they've said the skill levels at this World Cup have been fantastic.
So it's so good. That's what I think this tournament has definitely increased visibility of women's rugby. So people would be like, I know women's rugby, and I know women's rugby based on maybe my old university days, or you know, the third team at my club. So that's a different perception. But now they're like, wow, I've seen Ellie Kildon. She's amazing.
Well,
and that alone,
you could take clips from this World Cup and put it before any age group level and say, if you want to know how to cover this, or how to sidestep, or how to clear, or how to do this, you could pose those sections along with any other sections that you want to pick.
Yeah.
And that to me is the biggest leap forward in the last 4 years. And if we get this right, and it's a great final, hopefully that 4 years will just advance and we'll just have more of it. The point is, I think it's good enough now. It's the depth to which it goes, because lower down the teams and, you know, and the tiers and the unions and the age groups, it will start to be the same, and that's where we've got to aim for.
I just love the fact after the game, I tend to wander around, usually because I'm lost and I can't get out the stadium. But when I get the fans come and they say like, oh, can we get ask for your autograph? But it's been great when I've seen the England players or what other nationality players walking around and you've got boys and girls saying, can I have an autograph? Or like, you're my favourite player. Yeah. Like, it's brilliant. Like, I that's what I love about this environment. It's a real family orientated one and everyone feels inspired. Mums, dads, brothers, sisters, granddads, grandmas. I love it. It's been so good to see. And I do think that's a legacy of our sport. Yeah. You know, I'm hoping that we'll continue to have increased attendances at club games as well as international games. More people will want to watch it on
the
telly.
All the backup stuff that's been planned needs to be activated.
Mm.
And not just in England, the rest of the world. And it's unusual you'd say this, the rest of the world have to catch up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, listen, it's going to create some... We've had more conversations around professional contracts and people are a bit like, what do you mean Canada haven't got any money?
Yeah.
What do you mean Spain don't get anything? Samoa, what they've just turned up with on expenses? Mm. Like, that I think has really challenged people's perceptions of international rugby. You know, in the men's game, majority of them will still get money, but they still have their challenges. You know, there's Fiji, there's Samoa, who still have to fight for finance and support. But actually in the women's game, that's sort of more broader. There are more teams that have less support. So I think it's definitely got people to start to sit up and go, there needs to be support globally, and World Rugby are doing their bit, but what can other governing bodies do to support their women's side? Because it's important that they get that equality, and that's how you'll only make them better. And I like to think in 4 years' time, you know, 2029 in Australia for the Women's Rugby World Cup, we're going to see more than the top four teams. Yeah. We're going to be like, oh my God, six or eight teams can win this World Cup. It's a much more competitive event, which I think has improved, but it will get better.
We've got to wrap up now, which is a shame.
I'm loving our conversation.
But before we go, you know what's coming, don't you? What question's going to be asked now? As a final question.
It's got to be something around a score. Yes. Scores on the doors.
Yeah. A prediction.
Can I ask you first? I'm going to ask you first.
Oh, no, that's
not... Brian first.
I was trying to be... non-neutral, just for a kid.
Yeah, I like non-neutral. Look,
England, I want England to win.
Yeah.
Hopefully I don't betray that in anything I say on the day. I'll try not to. I think it's really important for women's rugby that England do win. Much though, I think the Canadians have done a great job. There are lots of reasons why England need to win this World Cup so they can justify, so that the input and the monetary input is continued and people aren't sort of saying, well, actually, we don't need to do it this way. I think it's really important. And the great thing about the England performances, even though they've been uneven, when you look round at the scoreboard, you suddenly thought, well, they've scored 40 points. So I think in the end, the benches might be the deciding factor. And I think England
will... What's the score? Got all day, so don't worry.
28-17.
28-17?
Yeah.
So... I will give him my response. So basically, naturally, so of course I want England to do well, but at the same time, I'm generally quite open. Either side, I would be happy with winning, just because, you know, England, the interest, they've already created a legacy. Whether they win or lose, they've created a legacy, and people will want to come back to watch more. Can you imagine if Canada won as well? Like a country.
Well, they can't both win.
No, I know they both can't win. So I've got to get off that fence. I've got
yes,
to get
exactly,
those,
yeah.
get the splinters out.
Yeah.
But then again,
let's time.
Look at the pros. If Canada won it, a country that's had very less funding, and if they go on to win it, I reckon there'll be a lot of people saying you need to fund our women. Mm. And they won silver in the sevens. They were in the last World Cup in 2014. I think that's a story. That's a movie if they go on to win that. So both teams, there is cons and pros for winning. I obviously want England
to
win.
And the answer is?
I'm going to say it's going to be incredibly close. But you know it's going to be different. So I'm going to say England will win it, but it's going to be like come down to 2 points or something silly. So I'm going to say like it's going to be 26-24 to England. But I'd be honest, I am on that fence. Those splinters, I tell you, I need to get them out because I generally believe the way Canada performed against New Zealand, England will look at that and be like, you know, they'll be worried by that because that was
my
performance.
There you've got it. Finally, we got there in the end. What time is it? What year is it?
But we got there in the end.
It's near
England
the next
will
one,
win, but it will be close.
We'll be in Australia in 15 minutes' time. That is the end of Off Script and Onside with me, Brian Moore, and the iconic,
the legend,
Maggie Alfonsi.